Today, the future of England's National Health Service. What does it need to survive another generation? And, in opinion, Hadley Freeman on Meghan Markle.
Well, it will be at least 4 weeks until the House of Commons
votes on the
vote
of no confidence in the Prime Minister that Jeremy Corbyn is
supporting on the referendum.
The Prime Minister has led us into...
It's all Brexit, Brexit, Brexit. But this week, they were supposed to be talking about the NHS. Money's tight, the population is ageing, and a winter crisis is coming. We were expecting the NHS long-term plan for England before Christmas. But like everything else, it's been delayed. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, can the NHS be saved? So the NHS is due to be putting out its long-term plan.
Yes.
Where is it?
The long-term plan has been delayed, firstly by Brexit and the political paralysis that that has caused. The government, basically, everyone says the government doesn't have the bandwidth, the time, the energy to concentrate on the detail of a hugely important plan to improve the NHS.
Dennis Campbell is The Guardian's health policy editor.
It's also been held up significantly by infighting, rows, disagreements between Simon Stevens and the NHS and 10 Downing Street and the Treasury and the Department of Health, because the politicians want it to maximise the amount of kind of promises, pledges, improvements it's going to make. And Simon Stevens is saying, essentially, hold on, the money isn't enough to do all of that and the workforce is a real problem.
The government always says it's putting loads of money into the NHS, and Simon Stevens, chief executive of the NHS, always says, no, you're not. Is this a significant increase?
So from David Cameron and the coalition coming in 2010, the NHS from then until now has got annual average increases of 1% a year. From April 2019, the NHS budget in England will go up by an average of 3.4% a year, every year for 5 years in a row. So it's a significant increase. But even that increase is below the NHS's long-term average. The NHS average annual funding growth in England between 1948, when it was set up, and 2010, when the coalition came in, was 3.7%. So that Theresa May is giving a lot more than her predecessors have given since 2010, but it's actually less than the long-term average.
And what is the gap between the money and the amount that he thinks needs to be done?
Simon Stevens asked 14 little teams of advisors to tell him, in all of the areas of care that the NHS does, what should we do? What would you ideally like to do if we could do it with the money? The cost of all those wish lists is going to be about 80 billion. He can only spend 20 billion a year.
And do you know where they've landed? What is going to be in the plan?
There's going to be major, major improvements to mental health. The profile, the political importance of mental health has gone up hugely in the last 4 or 5 years. Cancer, we're going now from 1 in 3 of us being diagnosed with cancer to now 1 in 2 of us because of the ageing population, etc. They're going to promise to transform the way healthcare is delivered in this country with a huge shift of resources and care out of hospitals. It needs to happen. It's really, really, really important that that happens. But I'm sceptical that it will happen. And there also needs to be huge improvements in the public health to stop people becoming unwell because they eat too much, smoke too much, or drink too much. Though the NHS only has a limited role in being able to do that, we need ministers to match the NHS plan with some tough legislative action as well.
To understand the scale of the issues facing NHS England, Dennis Campbell and our producer, Elizabeth Cassin, spent time in a busy hospital. From its control room and emergency department to diabetes and geriatrics, to see what the health service needs to cope with increasingly complex illnesses and a growing and ageing population.
So King's College Hospital is one of the NHS's biggest and best hospitals. It's a very busy district general hospital in Camberwell in South East London, one of the poorer parts of London. But it's also a regional center of excellence for many forms of medicine, really good care in cancer, in diabetes, in organ transplantation, for example. It's also, as a curiosity, one of the hospitals in the NHS with some of the biggest debts or deficits. But then given that most hospitals in the NHS have a deficit of some sort, that's not necessarily a badge of shame. So just off the main corridor is the Site Operations Centre, which is arguably the most important single room in the hospital. It's where everyone who keeps the hospital going, particularly the beds managers, do all their work. They're all there reporting back on how many beds they've got.
Okay, so the ITU, how many beds do we have as it stands?
None.
No beds. Okay. How many beds have you been given?
Two.
Okay.
Yeah. I've got one
at King's College Hospital. When we were there in the morning at the first of their three beds meetings of the day, they were 41 beds short of what they needed. In other words, they had 41 patients waiting for a bed, who'd been sitting there, a lot of them overnight waiting for a bed. Patients had been waiting for many, many hours.
It is minus 41. Okay, that's without our query discharges. Those are patients that haven't been reviewed by a consultant that are in the process. If they don't come off, it becomes minus 99, which is not good for a Monday morning. But that will change.
So they were in a pretty hairy situation already first thing in the day.
Was it frantic? Was it stressful?
No, it wasn't frantic or stressful. There was a lot of people on phones all the time to different departments of hospital, literally updating on the progress of patient A, B or C. When will they be going home? We need to know as soon as possible.
It's like a control room.
It was exactly like a control room, exactly. A bit like sort of a something you see at an airport or somewhere like that. Literally getting people, airplanes up and down, patients in and out, to stop the hospital becoming overcrowded and all jammed up, to stop the A&E unit simply becoming filled up with people in chairs and people in trolleys.
Can I please have a word of the wheelchair to reception? Thank you.
So we met Dr. Emer Sutherland, who's one of the senior doctors in their A&E department.
I can clearly remember when I started, the first time we went over 300 people arriving in the day, and we were so shocked at the volume.
Reasonably recent times, they've gone from having an average of 3 to now 400 patients turning up a day, though not long ago it had their all-time record of 498 patients arrive in one day. That's an awful lot of patients.
Just in A&E?
Just through A&E. She was telling us how more and more people arriving at A&E need to be admitted, therefore they need a hospital bed because they need, you know, inpatient care.
What sort of cases does Dr. Sutherland see, and how's that changed since she's been at the hospital?
So Dr. Sutherland's been a consultant A&E doctor at King's for 14 years.
There's a joke that A&E stands for always and everything, but we do end up with people who are dropped off at the door having been stabbed through the heart because of the location of King's College Hospital. We fly people in by helicopter who've been in a lorry crash down on the Kent coast. We have people who
the
are brought...
The caseload that Emer Sutherland and her colleagues are seeing has changed significantly in the last few years.
In some ways, actually, the number of people who come through the door isn't the issue, because we can have 500 people come through the door. If they've got minor illnesses or sports injuries, we'll get them all home. What tends to be a more difficult day for us can be 380, but with lots of people who might be frail, older people, lots of people who've got lots of medical conditions, so more complex issues.
These are nearly always older people who have 4, 5, 6 things wrong with them all at the same time. Typically, a problem with their breathing, probably related to a history of smoking, heart problems, angina, arrhythmia, all sorts of things like that. The earliest signs of dementia, perhaps. Depression, which is very often related to having one or more conditions, people become depressed. Could be cancer. It could be a recurring infection, some sort like a UTI, urinary tract infection. And very often, it could be diabetes.
How big of a problem is diabetes for the NHS?
Diabetes takes up about 10% of the NHS budget, more than £10 billion a year. There are more than 4 million people in the UK diagnosed with diabetes, and estimates of anything between 500,000 and 1 million more people going around with undiagnosed diabetes. It can make your sight much, much worse than very often does. It can affect your liver function. It affects many, many parts of your body, including your vital organs.
And there's people with type 1 diabetes, but increasing numbers with type 2.
90% of the people of the 4 million plus diagnosed diabetics in Britain have type 2 diabetes, which is very closely associated with obesity.
Tell us about the diabetes department at King's.
So the diabetes department at King's is one of their busiest departments. It's one of the regional centres of excellence they have. So when we went into the diabetic foot clinic at King's, the thing that first struck us was this. We heard a sawing sound, the sound of what sounded like a saw being used. And I knew that diabetes leads to amputations of body parts, but usually I thought that happens in an operating theatre. It turns out that that is there actually to help remove the cast that is put on the legs and lower limbs of people.
So as you came around the corner, were you expecting to see something different?
I was expecting to see a scene of kind of something verging on horror, but it turned out that actually it was a very routine thing going on. They were just taking off long plaster casts as if someone had a broken leg. So one of the many other medical problems that diabetes causes is what they call diabetic neuropathy, basically nerve damage, which can affect any part of your body, particularly your lower limbs. And that's why we end up with more than 100 people a week in the NHS having to have a finger, a toe, a foot, a leg amputated.
Who did you meet in the foot clinic?
So in the foot clinic, we met the diabetologist in charge, Dr. Prash Vass.
At the advanced stage of diabetes, it's about saving a life, saving a limb, keeping people alive longer. Say for example, the diabetic foot costs.
Feet problems for diabetics cost the NHS over £1 billion a year. He told us just that, over £1 billion a year. Over £1 billion a year. He said just for that.
Blimey.
Oh well, I was diagnosed with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, about 10, 12 years ago.
We were lucky in that one of the patients was very, very happy to talk to us, called Tony Madden.
I'm a director of an insurance broker in London, quite a hectic social life.
70-year-old gentleman, very friendly and very kind of jovial and positive and upbeat.
Probably drank too much at times, and I probably should have taken the condition much more seriously, much earlier.
Tony Madden's actually like a lot of diabetics I met, including diabetics in my family, people who didn't realise they were leading an unhealthy lifestyle, but they were.
What do you think could or should be done about it?
Well, my wife had a good idea. Why don't they bring people first diagnosed with it into this clinic and see the results of what it can do? But as I said, I think it should be on the level of smoking.
And secondly, he was very keen that he was talking about how not that long ago, the government of the day would run lots of very high-profile, in-your-face graphic campaigns against smoking, warning us all that smoking will do all these terrible things.
Go Tony. I totally agree with him. If the NHS just put a bit of money into diet programmes for people, couldn't they save billions in the treatments for things like diabetes?
Actually, Anusha, the NHS plan, we already know because it was announced recently, is going to include plans to majorly expand the diabetes prevention program to bring in programs where doctors will prescribe 800 calorie a day diets for many, many weeks then to try and, because there's growing evidence worldwide that adopting sort of a fairly extreme diet for only a few months can reverse diabetes.
So it sounds like the NHS is being really innovative in diabetes and really world leading, and presumably it's the same across a whole range of conditions.
Medical progress is one of the defining characteristics of the age we're all lucky to live in. The sum total of all of that progress is that more people are living longer, and people who frankly until 5 or 10 years ago would have died are gaining extra months and in some cases years of life. The more the NHS succeeds in keeping people alive, the longer the period they're going to need more care for. And the period when people live with disease or disability or injury is extended, and therefore that increases the demand. So by doing its job better, it's creating more work for itself.
So we're living longer because of these great advances. But as you say, the paradox is that does cause additional strains on the NHS. And there are big parts of King's College Hospital that are dedicated to that.
So one of the things that King's does more and more of is looking after older people who are unwell, but particularly older people with memory problems, with dementia. We met Dr. Catherine Bryant, a geriatrician who specialises in dementia, and specialist nurse Emma Aldred.
We need everything. Everything. So, yeah. better work. We've got a workforce that's fit for purpose, with better community services, better primary care, more GPs, better integrated care, geriatricians moving out into the community, better joined up social care, better mental health care for older people.
They were very frustrated because they need social care provided by local councils and the NHS to be working hand in glove, side by side.
What's happened is that social services have altered their eligibility criteria. So, for example, a lot of patients with dementia may forget to take their medication, but they can still provide personal care for themselves. Now, unfortunately, prompting with medication would make them ineligible. If they needed help with washing and dressing, they would get that help. So, of course, then, you've got a problem. Who's going to provide that support for patients to take their medication? And, of course, if they forget to take their meds or they take too many meds, they potentially will present in A&E. So it is a vicious circle, really.
So for 8 years in a row, local councils across England have had their budgets cut. So at a time of rising need for social care, the availability of it has diminished.
Can the NHS be saved?
Much of what I write about the NHS is about the problems that come up. Lack of staff, lack of money, social care not being available, all sorts of things. But actually, you know, you spend time with NHS staff and you go to NHS workplaces and you realise that there is kind of tremendous innovation going on, and actually we're living in an era of huge advances in medicine. And I actually think the NHS's future, as long as it's carefully nurtured and properly looked after by the government today, whoever that is, the NHS is going to be fine. Appreciation and love and admiration for the NHS is too deeply set in the marrow of people in Britain, and I think the long-term plan and the significant sums of money that are behind it are finally, long overdue, belatedly, a recognition by this government of that inescapable fact.
Dennis, thank you. And you can read all of Dennis's reporting on the NHS at the end of its 70th anniversary year at theguardian.com. Coming up, Guardian columnist Hadley Freeman on Piers Morgan and Meghan Markle's attention-seeking father, Thomas. Don't go away. Now, in opinion, Hadley Freeman on respecting women's boundaries. She says Meghan Markle's father and Piers Morgan have given us a masterclass in how not to do it.
So on Monday morning, Thomas Markle again went on TV to again complain about his daughter, Meghan Markle, now known as the Duchess of Sussex.
Does she have a streak in her, Thomas, of... You know, I called it social climbing a little bit.
He was on Good Morning Britain talking to Piers Morgan about his quote-unquote controlling daughter.
Well, she's always been a very controlling person, and that's part of her nature, but she's never been rude.
And he eagerly took up Piers Morgan's suggestion that his daughter had ghosted him.
The ghosting I don't completely understand.
By cutting her out of his life.
She's always been in charge.
We have a father who goes on TV to denigrate his pregnant daughter and wonder aloud, why, oh why, does she not want to see him? So this is now, I think we're entering the 6 months of Thomas Markle's media tour complaining about his daughter. The fact that she doesn't want her father around, a man who has disrespected her and exploited her ever since she got engaged to Prince Harry, rather than respecting this, the media is sort of depicting this as cold. This has been very much reflected in Piers Morgan's coverage of her.
I thought we were quite good friends, and then literally never heard from her again from the moment she met Harry. And there is a little bit of a pattern, sadly, where you look back through her life of her just jettisoning people that appear to be no longer of any importance to her. I mean, is that a character trait of hers?
As well as providing a frequent platform to Thomas Markle, he himself has written several articles about how Meghan Markle has ghosted him. Now, the story of Meghan Markle and Piers Morgan's history can be told very quickly. Several years ago, they once had half a drink together in a pub, and she then left to go on a date. Apparently, this was the start of a beautiful friendship with the amazing Meghan Markle, according to the headline on one of Piers Morgan's columns in the Mail that came out last year. He admitted in the column he hadn't actually seen Meghan Markle since that half drink in the pub, but ended his column by saying if he got an invite to the wedding, all would be forgiven. Apparently that invite never came because exactly a year later, he wrote a column describing her as a social climber who had dropped him like a sack of potatoes. And he has been very much encouraging Thomas Markle to say similar things on the TV ever since. It's interesting watching these two men, Thomas Markle and Piers Morgan, talk about Meghan Markle like this because it comes on the heels of a long year of discussion about female consent that we've seen in the media, particularly when it comes to high-profile women, but also for women in general. Almost a year ago, a short story came out in The New Yorker called Cat Person, which described a young woman going on a date with a man and her then deciding she didn't want to see him again and she sent him a text message saying so. He then texted her back saying, why, I really like you, why? And when she didn't reply, it ended with an expletive that I don't think I'm allowed to use on a Guardian podcast. Any women out there or anyone who knows a woman on Tinder will have seen on that person's Tinder similar exchanges. I'm not on Tinder myself because I'm with somebody, but my female friends who are on Tinder have often showed me private messages they get from men on the same website in which they'll say they don't want to meet up or they met up and they don't want to meet again. And you'll see these private messages saying, why, we had such a great time, why, bitch. That's why the cat person story struck such a chord. And I think that's why the Meghan story is striking such a chord, because we see that exact same dynamic now with Piers Morgan and Thomas Markle. She doesn't want to meet up with them. Women are allowed to have boundaries. This is something men seem quite reluctant to learn in a lot of cases. And they are now saying, why, you controlling, ghosting bitch. So it's very interesting to see that dynamic played out on such a high-profile stage. In both of these cases, we have men who feel that they are entitled to Meghan, that they have a right to her time. We've talked a lot about the importance of female consent and boundaries and male understanding of that. But it turns out for a lot of men, they really don't get it. And a lot of men feel that their feelings are still more important than those of women. And if they want to be with a woman, they should be.
That's all for today. My thanks to Dennis Campbell, the staff at King's College Hospital, and Hadley Freeman. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin and Josh Kelly. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executives were Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you tomorrow.